Okay, Bob, fast questions from the patrons. What do you say?
How do we know they'll be fast?
Well, we'll see what happens.
Right.
Patron Heather says, I have no question, but just want to say that as a relatively new therapist with my own family trauma history who has been practicing for the past 5 years, I hope to be like you when I grow up.
Oh.
Thank you for your insights and clear care that you show for your clients.
Well, that's nice.
That's very kind of Patron Heather. Patron Julieta says, Bob, would you talk more about what you like to do in your garage? You said that you're handy and artistic. I'd love to know more. Bob.
Sure. Well, lately, nothing, because we're doing the bathroom remodel, so my bathroom is in my garage, so I lost my shop. But I spent the summer making an English joiner's bench.
Where you use a lot of hand planes and that kind of
thing. Yeah. And I spent a fair amount of the summer tuning hand planes, and then I actually planed the surface of the bench because the construction lumber that you get at Home Depot is often twisted and cupped and warped. And so I planed the thing down. Man, I had to take like half an inch off one of the boards just to get it level with the others. Anyway, so the joiner's bench is there. I got a very small TV hanging in there on the wall and can put on the football game or whatever when I'm tinkering around. So I put that up. Lighting, I put in these long strips of LED lights because we had just spotlights and it was really dim.
Right. Next question.
Yeah.
Anonymous patron says, on a previous episode, you and Kirk mentioned that you don't take on clients who are suicidal.
Yes.
I was always under the impression that that's one place in therapy where you can talk about suicide. I was under the impression that if that's one place you can talk, that if it's one place, there's a missing word, if there's one place you can talk about suicide, it would be with your therapist.
Yes.
I now feel hesitant to bring anything like this up with my therapist.
Oh.
What would you do if your current client suddenly experiences suicidality, Bob?
I'd work with it. So this is what I do. I screen people. If I do mostly couple therapy now, so this has not come up much, but occasionally when I'm working with somebody one-on-one, if they're starting, I'll screen for it. I'll ask about it if I have reason to think that this is, you know, part of their history. And if that's the case, I'll ask a little bit more about it to find out, you know, to kind of get a sense of how likely is this to come up as a topic of therapy. And the reason is in part because it's really stressful for me. And the other reason is because I believe that the level of care that a person who has self-harm and suicidal thoughts and actions, they deserve a level of care that I cannot provide. My life isn't set up to be available in the ways in which I believe are ethically and morally responsible. So I don't take those kind of clients on because I don't like the stress and because I can't provide the level of care that I think is needed. That said, if somebody talked about it in therapy, and it does happen, it's happened twice in the last 18 months where two of my individual clients have talked about having those kinds of thoughts and impulses, I work with it. Now, it's possible that if that took more and more, if that showed up more and more, that I would suggest that I'm not available in the way they need and would suggest that they that we find them somebody else. But that's probably not going to happen, for one. And two, if it did, I mean, I have a very long-standing relationship with both these folks, and I would not easily refer them on because it would have to be pretty severe for me to refer them on for that. If that did show up, then I would probably work with it as best I could. Therapy is a place where you can talk about it. And if you're having those kinds of thoughts and impulses, it is a safe place.
It should be a safe place.
A good therapist, it is a safe place to talk about that stuff. You're not going to get carted off to the hospital. You're not going to be involuntarily committed unless there's an imminent danger to yourself in that immediate moment, which most of the time is not true. So if a person is having those kinds of thoughts and impulses, they absolutely should talk about it in their personal counseling, because you deserve to have therapy, A, that addresses you where you are, and B, that helps you stay safe. Mm-hmm. So I think that it sounds like I am just like turning my nose up at folks who have suicidal impulse. I spent many, many years working with folks who have.
You specialized in it.
Yeah.
For 20 plus years?
5 years. Yeah. So, I lost somebody once to suicide, as several folks on this podcast are aware. And that was awful. And it has had an impact on me, a scarring one. And I prefer not to work with those folks, but, that doesn't mean that I don't think that those folks absolutely deserve the best of care, or that I don't think that such care is out there. I know that it is. Mm-hmm.
My short answer to this is, I don't think I ever, you say, anonymous patron, on a previous episode, you and Kirk mentioned you don't take on clients who are suicidal. I don't remember saying that. If I did, that's not my policy. I'm not like Bob in this way. Yeah. I do take on clients who are suicidal, and I've recently worked with clients who were severely suicidal. Mm. Now, it's very important that for Bob, for example, he screens and informs up front. I do know that some therapists will not screen and not inform, and then when you do tell them that you have suicidal thoughts, they will refer you because yeah. It is their policy. And that is unethical and immoral in my book, because you could easily nip that in the bud and not harm clients by telling them up front and screening people. I mean, maybe there's one or two sessions that you get into it because it takes a bit of time to screen all the things you want to screen. But you certainly don't wait 6 months or 3 years and then suddenly disclose to someone, oh, by the way, that very normal thing that clients talk about, I am now going to refer you out because I don't deal with, that's my policy. That's not okay. It's also completely okay for a therapist to do what Bob is doing. It's similar to being a podiatrist versus a dentist. You don't go to the dentist when you have a foot problem, and you don't go to a podiatrist when you have a mouth problem. You have specialists, and they advertise as such. It's very understandable. The problem is a lot of therapists don't know how to advertise as such, and or they think they're good at everything.
Right.
That they can do dentistry, podiatry, psychiatry, you know, in the analogy to mental health of, I can treat suicide, right. I can treat eating disorders, I can treat personality disorders, I can treat trauma, right. I can treat everything. And it's possible, but not likely, because it's very, there's a lot of specialized area mm-hmm. that require a lot of expertise and know-how, and potentially even like what you're getting at of the level of care. Mm-hmm. You know, when you have 1 hour a week with someone, that's, you know, that's a certain level of care. But mm-hmm. for some things, like with suicide, with, you know, severe or imminent threat, and with eating disorders, for mm-hmm. example, you have to be working as a part of a team, typically with family, with other clinicians. And if you're not at a place in your career where you want to do that, or you're not really set up for that, then that's a specialty choice. You're just like, that's a level. It's sort of like if someone came to you or me and had severe schizophrenia, we would not treat them. Are we saying that if you're schizophrenic, we're rejecting you? No. We're just a podiatrist. We're not a dentist. You know what I mean? But if a client 3 years into therapy started to develop delusions, you and I wouldn't just kick him to the curb.
No.
We would be working with them so that they would get the best treatment available.
Yeah.
For me, I would, and I've done this where people have developed psychosis in the course of my treatment with them. And I was always their therapist and never terminated with them, which is my policy.
Right.
But I also said, you have to be talking with a psychiatrist, you have to be talking with your family, you have to be talking with a caseworker, and I'll be here and we'll talk, but we're not going to put a dent in the psychosis, and psychotherapy doesn't really have effectiveness with that.
Right.
But in terms of your adjustment to the issue and all the other things in life, you know, I'm here to talk about it. So, all right, let's take a break, get back, more questions, what do you say?
Yep.
Okay, we're back from the break. Let's do an OPP, an old patron praise, for those people who became patrons all the way back in early 2021 and have stayed patrons ever since. We have Vicky and Thea, who are upper tier patrons who did not list where they're from. We have Niasha, who's an upper tier, middle tier patron from Grenada Hills, California. Oh. We have Raven, middle tier patron from Oxford, Mississippi.
Oh, that's John Grissom's. That's where.
Yeah. Oh, really?
Yeah.
We have Corbin, who's middle tier patron from Salem, Alabama. We have Tatiana, middle tier patron from San Jose, California. We have Megan, middle tier patron from Santa Clara, California. And we have Susan, middle tier patron from God knows where. We also have Savannah from Atlanta. We have JS from Cumberland, Rhode Island. Justine from Fallon, Nevada. Isabella from London, Ontario. Amanda from Marina Del Rey, California. Kelly from Meadville, Pennsylvania. Do you know? Meadville. Mm-hmm. Manuel from the Philippines. Janelle from San Diego. Wow. Sam from Seattle. Angelica from God knows where. Middle tier patron Dylan from Arlington, Minnesota. Antoinette from God knows where. Middle tier patron Antoinette, middle tier patron Nora from God knows where, middle tier patron Diana from Simpsonville, Kentucky, middle tier patron Ruby from God knows where, patron Annette from Germany, I believe. We have Aubrey from Bellingham, Bryn from Bellingham,
wow,
and Katya from Berlin, Germany. Thank you so much for being a patron all of this time. Patron Julian wrote in, says, "Dear Bob, knowing that we both have experienced similar upbringings, I'm looking for your insight and guidance. I grew up with a mother suffering from narcissistic personality disorder and faced severe emotional neglect myself. Her words have left long-lasting scars on me, and I was also sexually abused by my older brother for years, age 3 to 7, a trauma she still downplays while favoring him, a trauma that my mom still downplays while favoring my older brother. All these experiences have left me grappling with self-worth issues, feelings of insignificance, and struggling with complex PTSD and OCD. I've been dealing with intrusive thoughts and hypervigilance, which makes navigating daily life incredibly challenging. I am currently in therapy, but I'm still finding it hard to cope. My questions are, what additional coping strategies would you recommend for someone in my situation? Furthermore, should I consider confronting my mother about this past with the hope that she might finally hear and acknowledge my pain? Bob.
Based on what you wrote that second about that second question, it doesn't sound like that'll bear any fruit. So I wouldn't recommend that unless you, for some reason, believe that she'll be responsive. Otherwise, you're beating a dead horse and setting yourself up to feel worse. So I wouldn't, based on what you wrote. Coping. Well, you know, whenever I hear that word coping, I always think DBT skills, because DBT skills are, you know, a lot about coping. And so as I think about it, is coping is when you are doing something, it's sort of like, I have chronic pain, and this is what I'm doing to kind of get through the day while I have chronic pain. And it's not to treat the chronic pain, it's just to kind of help me get through the day. So coping, I would think of, you know, distraction from your troubles, any kind of self-soothing that you can do, that helps you, you know, again, to help you feel better as you get through the day. And, let's see, coping. I don't really like talking about coping, at least not the definition of it I have in my head. So, and unfortunately I'm sort of out of DBT practice. So those skills don't leap to mind the way they used to. Friends, loved ones, people that care about you, having those folks in your life and populate your life. So like, you know, I'm a little bit of a recluse, so I have some very good friends, but I can't say that I lean on them in the way that I otherwise might or could. So having good friends is by itself not enough. So reaching out for support and care from the people who love you. Absolutely. Reminding yourself that you are not your struggles. You are not what you went through. It won't. That sort of strategy isn't supposed to take away the pains and the distortions that come with the things that you suffered. But it is useful to be able to contrast. We were talking about distortions last time you and I did an episode, so I'm thinking about distortions now. it's useful to be able to draw a distinction between the distortions and reality. So like for me, it's good for me to be able to think, oh yeah, that's that thing that I do that's distorted. Like for me, maybe it's a cringe, shamey thing that comes to mind. Okay, fine. And that's that thing that I do. And then Kirk gave me some good advice. He said, get angry. Somebody done you wrong. The appropriate response is to get angry. So for me, I go into these little shame bits and I think, oh God, I can't believe I did that. And Kirk's advice to me was, Bob, get angry about it. Get angry at your dad if he's the source, or your mom or whatever. Get angry about it. And I haven't, you know, we do more than one episode when we talk. So
you haven't had an opportunity.
I haven't had a chance to put that into practice. But when you said it, it had a lot of appeal.
Mm. Or at the very least, just get angry at that voice.
Yeah.
Even if you can't identify who injected
it's,
who it.
It's from.
Yeah. Just like, you know, fuck you, that part of myself that says that. You're dumb. I don't like you, and I'm not gonna kowtow to you because you're the shameful one. Mm.
Yeah,
you know.
Yeah, right.
Patron Cat from New Jersey says, "What are your personal feelings towards your therapist, Bob?"
Oh, I love him. He's a good guy. He ain't perfect, but he's a really good guy. And it'll be 7 years in a couple 3 months that we've been working together.
7 years.
7 years. Yeah. Wow. Really good guy. Recently he's been sort of priming this pump for a long time about getting angry with him. That there's room in our relationship for me to be angry with him and he won't reject me or run away. Right. Hmm. So last week he said something, I can't remember what exactly he said, but he said something and it sort of irked me. And I said to him, I would like to give you some feedback. And my therapist is no shrinking violet. So he'll accept feedback, but only if he thinks there's merit for it. So instead of just saying, oh, what's the feedback? He actually kind of went toe-to-toe with me. I mean, he wasn't confrontive. He wasn't a dick. I wasn't a dick either. But he's like, so, okay, so you're wanting to give me feedback about da-da-da-da-da-da. And he's like, so what is it? And I told him what it is. And he's like, okay, so it's not really specific. I'm not sure I understand exactly what it is that you mean. And I can't remember the other things that he said, but he led us down this path. And eventually he said, what do you want? And I started to cry. And I said, I want to know if you really are, I was tooting my horn about something. If you really are pleased for me. Because the response he gave me, I told him was cognitive. He gave me a cognitive response to.
Instead of just saying he was pleased with you.
Yeah, yeah. And you know, I don't know anything. I don't know if that was it wasn't useful feedback because it wasn't specific to what I wanted. And I actually didn't know what I wanted. I just know I was kind of irked.
I see. So you told him something that you felt proud of yourself about.
Yep.
He gave a cognitive response.
Yep.
And not a, I'm pleased with you.
Yep.
Then you feel irked, but you don't know what the irk is exactly.
Yep. Except I want him to change his behavior, but I don't know if I know what I wanted him to change it to.
Right. So then you have the relationship now where you can raise your hand and say, I have some feedback.
Yeah.
Which is a big leap.
It is.
But then you describe what the feedback is, but it's not clear because you're not clear yourself.
Yeah.
And then he is trying to clarify it.
Right.
Was that annoying when he's trying to clarify it?
No, it wasn't annoying. It was a little bit anxious. Like, I don't know what's going to happen. I respect him for not just capitulating and caving in and saying, oh, okay, well, feedback, blah, blah, blah. But for actually deciding for himself if he was willing to accept the feedback I was giving him. Because just because I have it to say doesn't mean...
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. If you're going to be a true relationship as a therapist,
yeah,
you can't just constantly succumb. You have to be in the room.
Yeah.
And maybe you have a process of diplomatically agreeing with something, but it's authentic, but you don't just say the client is always right.
Yeah, no.
Right.
No, the client is not always right.
Yeah.
And what he'll do is he'll sort of process out loud when he is sizing a thing up and he's sort of thinking on his feet or whatever. And then eventually ask me, do, you know, what is it that you want? And it dawned on me what I wanted, which was to know, are you really happy for me?
Mm-hmm. And then what did he do?
And he said, yeah, I really am.
That's great.
And that settled the feedback I needed to give him. That.
Well, you could argue it was a foray into that conversation.
It was.
Without that, you would have said, well, I don't really have a refined piece of feedback, so I'm just going to let it go.
Right.
You know, it's the beginning.
Yeah, it was.
And then he responded by saying, okay, let me understand this.
Right.
And it wasn't confrontational or aggressive or rejecting. He's just like, let me get this.
Yeah.
And then he's still kind of confused, which is fine.
Right.
And then he asks a clarifying question that is in your parlance, right? You've been asked that a lot and you have a way to get there yourself. And then you took the leap and you told him, and that's great.
Yeah. That was good.
I mean, it's a perfect interaction, really.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like what happens ideally between people.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, I love him. Great guy.
Yeah. Patron Cat from New Jersey has another question. Since your relationship with your dad was not the best, do you see him as a father figure?
My therapist?
Do you see your therapist as a father figure? Yeah, you're right.
Oh, yeah, without question. Yeah, which is really fucked up because he's 7 years younger than me, which drives me nuts.
I don't think I knew he was younger than you.
Yeah.
That's funny. Yeah. I mean, it doesn't matter, of course. But
it doesn't, but it still drives me nuts.
You get to a certain age and pretty much everyone's younger than you.
Well, that is true. That's true. And one thing I could say is however long I need him, he probably won't retire.
Patron Bob wrote in
and
said, no question, just appreciation for you opening up about your struggles in life. You have helped me immensely.
Thank you. I'm glad.
Patron Mari or Mary says, do you ever get bored being a therapist? I'm finishing up my bachelor's and I'm planning on applying to graduate school for counseling soon. Mm. I'm excited, but a little worried I might be bored with seeing clients all day long. I am currently an EMT right now, and I'm scared I'll miss the adrenaline rush, even though that isn't sustainable for me anymore. Huh. Love the show, by the way. It has helped me a lot. Bob, what do you think? Do you ever get bored?
Yes, but usually it's not what it means. Okay, so what I think is if you're bored in therapy, you're not doing your job. You're phoning it in. So I refuse to phone it in. So I don't get bored very often, but I'll be honest, I have been feeling kind of bored at times lately. And I'm like, well, what the hell, man? I mean, the other day I said to myself, these people pay me a fair amount of money, pretty good money, to listen to me. And what I get to offer is love and care. Like, what could be better than that? And then I realized, God damn, I need a vacation. Mm. It's just been a bit, I've been working a lot of hours, it's been pretty nonstop lately, various parts of my life, and I need a break. So to me, I wouldn't call it boredom, it's more like restlessness. The restlessness means I just need a vacation.
Right.
But I do not get bored. I used to when I was very young therapist, it was because I really didn't understand my job. Mm. And I have
You're more of a technician back then.
Yeah.
And that will get boring.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, what they say the first 5 years of being a therapist, you're honing technique, right? And hopefully getting a lot of training and supervision. That can only help. But I don't get bored. Sometimes I get annoyed and irritated, yeah. Sometimes I'm elated with joy, yep. Sometimes I'm moved, yep. But bored, no.
Yeah.
If you're bored, you're not doing your job.
Well, there's also a lot of different versions of bored. You describe, I think, burnout, boredom.
Yeah.
I will say that and then you also describe early career boredom that I didn't experience for whatever reason. But you were, I guess, I don't remember knowing this back then, but you were more cognitively oriented, strictly cognitively oriented, it sounds like.
Yeah, probably. I mean, I don't know what I was back then.
But not very attachment oriented.
No, not at all.
Yeah. And I was. I was pretty, you know, they made us choose a theory to write about in our case consultation class back then, at least in the CFT side. And I chose object relations, which is essentially attachment.
My first therapist was object relations. My first really good supervisor was object relations, and I absorbed a lot from him about that. But I was more cognitively behaviorally oriented. Yes, that's true. I don't really love that anymore. But
was it a legacy from your previous job, which was more case management? Because I find that a lot of people will, when they step into the therapist role,
yeah,
they will use skills and mindsets that worked for them in the past.
Well, yeah.
Even if it was a previous career. Like if I'll have a former teacher who taught fifth graders, and then they're stepping into the role of being a therapist, and they're insecure about being a therapist. And even though they know they're different things, they'll start to act like a teacher because they know how to act like a teacher. So I don't know if that's maybe what you're running.
That's
into.
Probably everybody does something like that in some way.
Well, I didn't have any skills heading into being a therapist, so I didn't have anything to fall back on.
You were channeling nothing from previous part of your life.
No, I mean, what would I possibly be channeling?
I don't know. Work, business stuff? I don't know.
Yeah, no. I mean, there's nothing. I was terrible as a shoe salesman. As a very reluctant shoe salesman.
But I started learning DBT in the late 90s. So that was, we finished school in 90. We finished school in the same year, 97. And I started learning DBT in 99, somewhere in there. And
pretty technician oriented.
Yeah. There was a lot of technician-ish stuff to learn. I mean, that's a pretty thick manual.
Yeah.
To absorb that.
There's homework and modules, and there's even an active funneling of topics so that clients don't necessarily get into their personal stuff.
Yeah,
so there's various different types of boredom. I will say that another type of boredom is just, I think, the core of boredom where, say, I guess a common the thought I have is that I'm with my wife and we're at the mall and she's shopping for something that I have no interest in, which that sounds super gendered, but this doesn't happen very often. I would guess it's literally probably happened like 3 times in my life.
Yeah.
And I'm tired or something. So I just sit down I find somewhere to sit.
Yeah.
And back in the day before smartphones really had things we could entertain ourselves with, I would just be sitting there, staring into the nothingness, and I'd be bored.
Yeah.
I'd be thinking I'd be rather doing something else right now to entertain me. I wish there was a TV or a smartphone. It's funny how there's not a lot of opportunity to get bored anymore because of smartphones, you know. But I have had that experience very rarely in therapy. The examples I can think of are kids or teens who did not want to be in therapy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Or a kid who was very non-communicative with me. Mm-hmm. Like I had this one client years and years ago who she loved to draw, and that was the only thing she wanted to do. She didn't want to talk, but she loved to draw. And so over weeks and weeks of me trying to, you know, create an interaction or engage her, we landed on this activity. She would walk in my office. I think she was, I don't know, maybe 10 or something. Mm-hmm. And she would draw these elaborate pictures of all these little figures, and they'd be doing all these, you know, like there's these guys who were going down a jump, and these people who are swinging on a vine, and it was very interesting. And I would, you know, with other kids that will do stuff like this, I would say, "Oh, what's that?" And you know, eventually they want to engage with me. Mm-hmm. They want me to be interested in their drawing. This kid didn't care at all. I was just a gnat in her ear that she was trying to get rid of, but was easily ignored. You know, and week and week after week, and eventually I pulled the parents in and I told them, you know, I've been trying to crack this nut for a long time, and it's not seemingly working. So, and I think I suggested that we terminate because of that. But I think I treated her for a year or two, or it was a long time. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there was some, I feel like I remember there was some headway that I thought might be happening within the sort of play draw therapy, but it was I was very bored, and I remember literally 7 minutes into the session, I'd be looking at the clock going like, oh my God, I have another 43 minutes of this stuff. Mm-hmm. Like, and it, just constantly looking at the clock, because she's just drawing and I'm just sitting next to her, you know? And So yeah, in those moments, yeah, I'm bored. Mm-hmm. Because it is an empirically boring situation. I remember I had a teenager that I was doing in-home therapy, and he was on the couch, and he acted like he was sleeping the whole time, but he wasn't sleeping. And so, yeah, that's boring as shit, because I'm just sitting here next to him on the couch saying, after trying for 5 minutes to engage and getting nothing, and then every 5 minutes I'd say, like, so we could play a game, or do you want to look at YouTube, or, you know, whatever you want to do, it's up to you, you know? And I'm not the sort of therapist or person that's going to strong arm a client to talk with me. So, and back then I needed the money. So now if something like this happened pretty quickly, I'd be like, okay, let's call this quits, because for your sake mainly, but you know, mm-hmm. kind of also for mine. Mm-hmm. So, but back then I was willing to see those things through to, and eventually I did with that teenager. He eventually did. He's the kid who taught me how to play 13.
Oh, see, you just needed the right medium.
Yeah. The other kind of boredom I'll mention is that there's a boredom that I've never experienced, but I have known therapists who they would describe it as boredom, but really what I think a more elaborate way of describing what they're experiencing is, their heart really isn't into being a therapist.
Oh, yeah.
And so they at some point figure out that and learn that maybe therapy isn't for them, or they can only maybe treat 5 clients a week or something, if that. I've had supervisees that ran into this, and there's no way to know, because unlike other kinds, you know, if you want to become a cook, for example, you can cook at home and experience what that's like. You can't be a therapist until you're a therapist.
Yeah.
So you don't know how the shoe is going to fit, if you will.
Right.
Recalling on my Foot Locker days.
Or even, you know, you find yourself doing this kind of therapy, but really that's not your bag. Like when I first came out of school, I was a kid therapist, which was not my bag. And so when I found...
I didn't know you were a kid therapist. Or...
Yeah. I worked on the child and family team at the...
Oh, I think I did know that, yeah.
Yeah. For... a year? No. A year and a half? Some length of time.
Wow.
And I'm not good at it, and it's not really my thing.
Mm-hmm.
And,
yeah, you could have become good at it, but you didn't want to.
I tried to, but it's not a fit for me. So I think kid therapists are...
Well, is it that it wasn't a fit, or you didn't want to?
Well, they're both true.
Okay.
Like, I don't understand play therapy.
Could have understood it if you...
I could have. Yeah, you're right. So the main thing here is I didn't really have an interest in it.
You didn't want to, yeah.
I didn't want to, so...
Because there's a lot of things about therapy that boggled us at the beginning of our careers.
But right.
Some of the things you were willing to work
to
through.
To work through, yeah. So, but that I didn't really have that interest, so that was the wrong field for me.
Mm-hmm.
Subfield.
Right.
So...
But for some therapists,
yep.
No matter what type of client they... are just not interested. It's not fulfilling to them. Yeah. It's not interesting.
Right.
It might be initially kind of interesting, but not for very long. And that's a huge bummer, because someone spent tens of thousands of dollars and several years of their life.
Right.
And also the humiliation of now going to all your friends and family and saying, yeah, I guess I made the wrong choice. It's rough. And it happened, you know, close friends of ours in graduate school, I think, discovered that for themselves.
Who?
Well, I don't want to name names, but
then never mind.
People we knew very well in graduate school
pretty
quickly were no longer therapists after graduating from...
Oh, right. I'm now remembering some of the folks.
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah.
Like people that went through the exact same classes you and I did.
Yep.
And they graduate and immediately stop being a therapist. They had their internship where they're a therapist, and then they graduate and never treat another client. You know, they did a completely different career.
Yeah.
Presumably because... they didn't like doing it.
Yeah.
And or they were bored.
Right.
Right.
I had two professors in college who said to me, well, one of them said to me, you don't know that you want to be a therapist. I found it boring. He said that. And then another one who I actually just traded emails with about two or three months ago. Really lovely guy. Tom Borkovic. You ever heard of him? Yeah. Oh, yeah. He's a cognitive researcher. He was a professor at Penn State. And he said to me in his email, he's like, I never really had the chops for treating patients. So his career was spent. Now, before, when the only way to hang a shingle was to get a PhD or an MD, you have lots of choices. So he could be a professor and a researcher, and that was a good fit for him. And he didn't have to become a therapist, and he could still use his training and education, you know, in that way. So, and then I had a psychiatrist sort of colleague in the clinic I worked at when I moved here. And he's like, you don't know if you want to be a therapist and treat people all day long. I think he was bored with his job. And so.
I mean, yeah. You just don't know.
Just don't know.
Or over time, you might find it less fulfilling and less interesting.
Yeah.
So it's hard.
Yeah.
That does happen. All right. So let's take a break.
Yep.
More questions.
Right.
All right. Back in the break. Anonymous patron says, how do you get through tough days?
I think they mean tough work days or tough days.
I think tough personal days.
Oh, one foot in front of the other. I do stuff that has value to me or some meaning to me. Sometimes by checking out, like, so we'll binge watch a show or whatever. Sometimes tinkering in the garage. Sometimes talking to Colleen, like we call them drive-bys, you know, where like she'll walk through the living room and she'll bend down and she'll kiss me, and that's like a drive-by. And sometimes we have drive-by chats. Very rarely I'll turn to my friends.
Patron Taylor says, Dear Bob, I started listening to the podcast in 2020 at the start of the pandemic, shortly after entering my own therapy and wanting to know more about the process. I realized I wanted to be a therapist, but I thought I was too broken to help anyone. Oh. Your vulnerability about your own struggles gave me the courage to do it, despite my fears and insecurities. I graduated with my master's in mental health counseling this past May, 2023, and I'm working in private practice. I love what I do, and I can't thank you enough for simply being yourself. And of course, a huge thank you to you, Dr. Honda. I swear I got a full education from you before I even started school. So that's a nice
thank
email
you.
To you.
Thank
pretty
you,
amazing to think about.
Yeah, congratulations. Wow,
that,
fantastic.
That you were the factor that helped Taylor to...
Wow, yeah.
You know? Such a big deal.
Hey, Taylor... Is it turning out to be, what do you notice about this quote unquote brokenness and how it either affects or helps you in your work? Like you thought you were too broken. What are you discovering now that you're working?
Yeah.
I bet at least some of the time you're discovering that the thing that you called broken is an asset.
Mm-hmm. Taylor goes on, my question for you, Bob, is do you ever take a patient's feelings of being stuck or frustrated in therapy personally, like it says something about you as a therapist? If you do, how do you parse out what might be their stuff and what is your stuff? Or what do you do with the feeling more generally? I go through these waves of feeling inadequate myself. I am lucky to have an amazing supervisor and therapist, and yet I continue to feel badly about myself. So it sounds like Taylor, which is a very common early career thing, by the way, and really throughout a career, but particularly early career, that when a client, I mean, so what Taylor is saying, do you ever feel frustrated when a client is stuck? And that's a phrase you hear a lot, and I think it is a product of the false notion that somehow change in therapy happens very quickly for everybody.
Right.
You know, for some clients it does, but for a lot it doesn't. And so this notion of being stuck, I think, is a distortion of the therapist.
Yeah.
And maybe of another client as well, because clients believe they're supposed to move fast. But anyway, so what Taylor is saying is that they feel inadequate when a client's progress doesn't seem to be moving very fast or at all. How do you deal with it, Bob?
Well, yeah, with greater frequency than I'd like to have happen, or maybe even admit, I have this I get stuck in this thing, but it has nothing to do with the client and everything to do with me and my own sense of inadequacy and a feeling that progress is supposed to look like something. I mean, when we think that progress is supposed to look like something, that's a hell of a lot of hubris to believe that we know what ought to be happening. I would say that when I'm stuck in that, it means I'm missing something important, like what actually is happening and projecting and sort of, you know, it doesn't matter. And so sometimes I feel irritated and sometimes I feel ashamed. And in both cases, it's really the same thing, which is a distortion on my part. And this sort of the sense that I'm responsible for, you know, whatever I think is supposed to happen. But I rely on my good friend Kirk, who will occasionally remind me that that ain't my table. And when he says it, because I know and trust him and trust his clinical skill, it helps me just take a step back and relax, which the longer I practice, the less I get stuck in that thing. And the more I find myself sort of thrilled about, instead of, oh, this client is stuck, it's sort of like, I wonder what's going to happen now. Mm. So,
yeah, the analogy that I can think of is when I was a kid and we'd be driving from Seattle to Spokane,
right,
which is about 6-hour drive, 5-hour mm-hmm. drive, mm-hmm. that I, as a young person, would ask my parents constantly, are we there yet? Are we mm-hmm. there yet? How close are we? Are we there yet? Because I didn't have experience with time or trips.
Right.
My parents are experiencing the same thing, which is the arduousness of long-term car journeys. But they have the experience, being their age and having done this enough times, to know that they're not there yet, but they will be. There's no noticeable change in terms of how close you are, right? You're 300 miles and now you're 299 and a half miles. It's not a huge feeling of progress, right? But you know that if you continue on the journey, eventually you will make the whole 300 miles. Mm-hmm. With therapy, in the beginning of one's career, you don't necessarily have the track record or the felt experiences of the entire trip with right. long-term clients.
Right.
And so in the moment, you're thinking, we're not moving. We're just sitting here in a car going nowhere. Are we there yet? We're never going to get there. But over time, you, with the right supervision and mindset, mm-hmm. you will experience the journey. You'll like, I have clients where when we look at any particular, maybe even over the span of 12 months, we won't see much of a difference. But when we look over the span of 7 years, we see huge differences. Yeah. And through that, we can extrapolate to each individual year that might have felt like nothing was happening and say there were definitely things happening and it was definitely progressing.
Yeah.
It just, in the micro blinders over your eyes, you're just looking at this micro moment. And yeah, I guess you could argue it was close to being static, but not. It was just progressing at its normal pace. The other thing that I tell people is that even if it is going nowhere, it's not your fault, because you're doing the best you can, or at least you should be. And if you're doing the best you can and you have a supervisor and a therapist that is signing off on things, then it doesn't matter if things aren't going anywhere, because you don't have any fucking control over it, and you never did. Yeah. And any notion that you do is hubris. You just are this person doing your best, and you're not a god. Patron Vicky from Argentina says, "Hi, Bob. I'm a sailor.
Wow.
I've been sailing for many years, and I know that I'm in my healthiest place mentally. And now that I'm in my healthiest place mentally that I've been in, it's getting harder to leave home to be a sailor." Just shaming near. I think by sailor, Vicky means someone who works on boats.
On boats.
Like a cargo ship or something.
Yeah.
Because sailor sounds like someone who is on a sailboat or something, but I don't think that's what
right.
Vicky means.
Navy kids, they call them sailors, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
After a few conversations with other crew members, I've started wondering if there's something about us sailors that we're running away from. Or because what Vicky's saying is, you know, I've been sailing my whole life
right.
when I was unhealthy. And now that I'm healthy, I'm finding it I don't want to leave home anymore. So it makes me wonder if the original reason why I was sailing away from home was because it was an unhealthy part of avoidance or something like that. So I've started wondering if there's something about us sailors that we're running away from, or something we find at sea that we don't have at home, like family, a sense of belonging, structure, etc., which you could also see, right?
Yeah.
By the way, I'm considering going back to school and I'm interested in psychology. Thank you all for sharing so much, and especially to you, Bob, for being such a wonderful human. Cheers.
Thank you.
So any thoughts about avoidance of sailors?
Well, it just sounds like growth to me. Like, you noticed that when you were sailing, it was fulfilling to you and it was meaningful. And now you're doing, now something has happened that you're calling getting healthier. I mean, isn't that describe everybody's growth? And you notice that your interests have shifted along with your growth. So I just want to reframe this as like normal growth. Like everybody, hopefully, well, not everybody, we all have the potential for growth from wherever we are to wherever we can, from wherever we were to where we are now. And so what I'm interested in at this age with this kind of growth is different from what I was interested in at that age with wherever I was then. So
yeah,
good on you.
Yeah. I mean, Vicky, I could see this being a thing where people grow up in trauma and there isn't a sense of stability or routine or structure or belonging. And then you happen upon, or you are attracted to things like this, being a sailor or being in the military or something. And it is a step up, but it's not ideal because it's under some corporate or government or some other power structure that you don't have a lot of control over, and there's a lot of downsides. And your relationships aren't necessarily too stable because you have a hard time creating stable relationships because they're so dependent on the job, right? But it's a interim step in the direction of health, in the direction of corrective experiences. Enough, like it's enough that you can trust it, but you don't have to get too involved in it. Then you start to heal and you find it in a later stage that you want even something higher on the stability, and you are trusting of yourself to be able to be a little bit outside the box of structure to cultivate a life and security with others. I mean, that's what it sounds like you're saying, Vicky.
Yeah.
One more question. Patron Mel from Melbourne says, what advice would you give someone who is mid-career choosing between pursuing counseling or psychology? So I think what Mel is saying is that their mid-career in another field, like banking or something.
Chemical engineering.
And they are trying to decide between counseling or psychology. And in Australia, they have a different system.
Oh, well.
But I think it's similar. We'll assume it's similar to, you know, counselors are master's level folks who are just trained and educated to do counseling.
Right.
And then you have psychologists that are trained to do counseling, but also other kinds of things, research and assessment.
Right.
So Mel says, I've worked as a careers teacher and love working with kids, but I feel like I can do more in the world, particularly because of you and Dr. Kirk. You two are truly inspirational.
Wow.
So what advice would you give someone who was mid-career as a careers teacher, which is ironic on some level, and thinking about pursuing a career in mental health, but trying to decide between counseling or psychology?
It really depends on what you want to do. If you want to be a counselor, then just go get a counseling degree. Like here, you can get a master's degree and that sets you up to have a license and you can be a practicing therapist. And that's good enough.
Not only good enough, but you know, in my experience, psychologists, they get taught no more counseling skills than master's level folks.
Right. They just get taught four or five other things too.
Right.
So, but you don't need those four or five other things in order to be a good therapist. So if you want to be a counselor, a therapist, just get the minimum training that you need in order to be successful and legal to do that. And if you want to do the other things, then your training should be commensurate with whatever your goal is. They used to think in the US, they used to think, you know, a PhD was like the right thing to get if you want to be a therapist. It's completely unnecessary. And it comes out of probably a very good lobby and a very good organization that could protect itself. Yeah. But
It's also just general elitism and
yeah,
and prestige.
Right.
And it also could be related to the past where 30 years ago, 40 years ago, and maybe even coming up to the time when you and I got educated, yeah, it was still kind of in this direction where
it was.
The field of counseling was completely unregulated,
yeah,
in the way that like being a coach is unregulated today. Right. And so accreditation and education and requirements, there were none.
Yeah.
So you could be a counselor at that point. Yeah. All right. Well, let's adjourn there. And everyone, please take care of yourself because
you deserve it.